All right, hey everyone, this is Jerry Fabiano, KYGT, LPFM, 102.7, 103.9, and this is The Rabbit Hole coming at you live here from the center of that universe, and that is Clear Creek County, Colorado, and it's day before Easter, day before April Fool's Day, but also in memory of, and there's just so many powerful emotions at play here, Helen, and in the studio with me is Helen Starbuck. We're going to be talking about her work, but we're both from that generation, what it felt like when those men were cut down, those the movements that were going on then, the civil rights, the peace movements, and I had commented that I listened to the '60s channel on Sirius a lot, and I hear that song, Dion's song there about Abraham, Martin, John, and Bobby, and and I hear it, and it's okay. But to sit here and think about and talk about it, I start to choke up on it.
Yeah, yeah. And if you watch any of the, the films of that time of like JFK's funeral and stuff, it just breaks your heart.
Yeah, it does. And so salute, hats out to them, and we keep on going. So, yep. We're here today, and we're here to talk about your work. This is Writer's Talk now on The Rabbit Hole. So, and I am sponsoring this particular hour. So if you would like to learn more about my work, Sisyphus Wins, by all means, just go to my website at jerryfabianic.com. And I want to thank all our sponsors, because without them, community radio like this is not possible. We could sit down and have conversations in depth, not 12, 18 minutes like you might get on CPR, NPR, or some other station like that.
Yeah.
We sit here for a good length of time and really get into what got you writing and so on, and call it Writer's Talk. So I'm excited, Helen. Welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate the invitation to come.
All right. And, I had your bio I was going to read, but tell us more about it. You're a retired nurse now?
I don't think you ever retire from being a nurse.
It's like teaching. Yeah. You
know. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I no longer work in the OR. Up until recently, I worked for a nursing journal that's specific to operating room nurses. The PC term now is perioperative nurse. But that was where I grew up, was in the OR. And when I worked in the OR, it was kind of like the Wild West. It's gotten very, and rightfully so, and it's helped improved outcomes for patients. But there is a lot more checklists to go through and double checking on things and certain behaviors not condoned anymore. It's a much more serious environment, and it should be to care for patients appropriately. But I spent my formative years in the OR. It's kind of where I developed my mouth and learned to stand up for myself, and really enjoyed it. It's a great place to work. A little intimidating to some people, but I really liked it.
And let's talk, because I want to come back to this, because you had said something in that, Helen. And I wanted to see about, and you, this is my word, not yours, not in the back. You said you called the OR room back in the day the Wild West. And
yes.
I say, okay, Bedlam rules, and how that might tie in with your writing too. But I want to come back to that a little bit later.
Okay.
But, so you have quite a bit, personal history dealing with, blood, guts, and gore, and bottom parts, and, trauma and all that other stuff there. What brought you into writing?
Well, I've written privately since I was in junior high. Of course, as I say, at that point in time, it was about the Beatles. a good friend and I had a crush on Paul, and she had a crush on Ringo, and we would write stories and exchange them in French lab, which is probably why I never learned to speak French very well.
And, how about Michelle? He sings, in French.
Oh, I know, I know. There were so many songs that he and John wrote. As an adult, I'm more drawn to John because I really enjoy his humor and his intelligence. And I still like Paul, but I think we all fell on Paul because he was such a cutie.
mm-hmm. So that was your roots go back to. Yeah, I don't find that uncommon. Mm-hmm. I speak to a lot of authors come out here and I say, "When'd you get?" And many of them say, "I started writing when I was in the fifth grade, when I was in the seventh grade."
Well, I think it's also tied to people who like to read. That's something I've always liked to do. Mm-hmm. I can remember holding up in the library in grade school with books. And I was never one of those popular kids. Spent a lot of time wishing I were. And so books and writing took the place of being a cheerleader or, whatever you the popular kids were doing. And I think a lot of times writers are like that. They're a little more introspective. They're maybe not part of the in crowd. And so they fill that space with more interior things like books and writing.
Yeah. Yeah. And that would be an interesting conversation, is the introvert versus the extrovert type. So I can maybe it's stereotyping, the cheerleading squad, the Palms, probably wouldn't be authors down the road if they're that extrovert type there. So, and I like the way you put that, the introvert. Was there an author, and I know you like to write about the Beatles, but did you have an author or any of them that inspired you that you kind of would read, Toni Morrison or somebody, that.
I loved, growing up, Daphne du Maurier. Mm-hmm. Her Rebecca really made a huge impression on me. I loved her book, Don't Look Now.
Okay.
And I loved the movie with Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie. It's a wonderful movie. And recently I read her My Cousin Rachel. And Rebecca and My Cousin Rachel are mysteries, in a sense. The reader's being pulled in one way and pulled in another, and you're never quite sure till the end what's really going on. So her books, for me, still resonate very strongly. And a recent author who I would give my right arm to write like is Tana French. She writes a Dublin Murder Squad series, mm-hmm. and I love the way she takes a character in one book, and you see that character in one way, and then in the next book, she takes the character that was sort of dismissed or criticized or not very favorably portrayed, and you actually get to see that character and realize that there's this whole other side to this character that you didn't know. And she does that through all her books, and it's amazing.
Mm-hmm. And you aspire to do that. You have your work out now. It's the Mad Hatter's Son.
Yes.
Okay. I haven't read it yet. I assume you have a protagonist in there.
Yes. My main character is Annie Collins. She's an OR nurse. Mm-hmm. It's right what you know.
Exactly.
And she gets very unwillingly drug into caring for an old friend that she's been estranged from for a few years. And the woman wants her to help find out what's wrong with her. She's experiencing some symptoms that her doctors and her husband are attributing to a miscarriage. And it puzzles Annie for quite some time trying to determine whether Libby is actually sick, if there's actually something going on, or whether this is psychological and she's kind of milking it for attention. Mm-hmm. And Annie's never really sure. And then when Libby apparently commits suicide, then there's a lot of guilt about, I should have done this, I should have done that. And she begins investigating what actually happened. And then that in turn, places her in jeopardy. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the outline of the story.
Sure. And we want to do the spoiler alert and don't want to give away the exciting conclusion.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that because when I wrote my book, there's one character in it that after people have read it, they just loved.
Yes.
And understandably so. He's very noble.
Yes.
However, then you want to say, well, nobody's pure and perfect.
Right.
That we all have that other side to us. which makes us human.
Right.
Okay. I assume even Mother Teresa had.
Oh, I'm sure she did.
Yeah, you know, whatever, you know. But, you know, so how do we show that? And so in my next work, I've taken that more noble character, and I mean, still noble, but mm-hmm. the travails that he needs to go through. And so, and who was the author you mentioned? You says, I would kill to write for, write like.
Oh, Tana French.
Tana French. Okay. And I haven't read her, but that's an intriguing style,
mm-hmm.
if you can, because it, for me, what drives me in any story are the characters.
Yes, for me too. And this will be a series, and so as the series progresses, Annie's life changes, and you get to see a little bit more of how things have gone for her, both in the past and currently. So I'm hoping to attract readers with the first book, and hopefully they'll be intrigued enough to read the second and the third and so on.
Oh, absolutely. And I think what I understand, you know, in talking to those who have created trilogies, at least, or a series mm-hmm. in some way, is that strain that runs through them, it is the character.
Yes.
And so when I wrote my work, Sisyphus Wins, to me it was a standalone piece of fiction. But when I got done and I started talking to folks, and they went, well, what happens to so-and-so? So what happens after this? And I know then they're hooked into the story because there's always more. And how do I play that out?
Well, and I thought this would be a one-off too. And then when I finished it, I was kind of like a mom who'd sent her kids off to college. It was like, oh, I'm going to miss them. I don't want them to go away.
Yeah.
And so that kind of triggered the idea for a series. It didn't feel like the story was finished, mm-hmm. which I had thought it would be. So it's been interesting to me how the characters, I don't want to get too woo-woo, but how the characters sort of come alive and direct the story.
Mm-hmm.
I've had some characters that I thought were going to be very minor people, and they've sort of said, no, I'm not going to be minor at all. I'm going to play a big role in this. So that's an aspect of writing that's always intrigued me. I don't know if we are tapping into an alternate universe where these people really are alive, or if your imagination just kind of goes off the deep end, or maybe you need psychotropic meds. I don't know. Haven't decided.
Oh, you must be reading my mind, because that was going to be my question then. How do these characters come to you? Because I've had authors come on and say, literally, they're in my dreams.
Well, they are. And somebody asked me recently, how do you pick names for them? And it's like, you know what? They name themselves. Something just fits. Mm-hmm. And my two main characters that will carry through the book, of course, is Annie. And then her next door neighbor and good friend, Angel Cisneros. And those two kind of routinely come to me, usually 3 o'clock in the morning, which it's like, guys, could you like come before I go to bed? things will pop into my head if I'm out walking or driving. I listening to music. I enjoy music a lot. And sometimes things will trigger ideas. And that keeps you going too.
Yeah. And that 3 o'clock in the morning, because you think, you know, when you wake up,
mm-hmm.
the mind now was cleared of clutter from the previous day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an entry point then for these characters, their energies, their forms, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I totally get it. And I had a gentleman on, an author a few weeks ago, and he says what he's learned to do is that when he wakes up and he thinks of something, you better write it down.
Yes.
Then, because if you wait till after breakfast, it's gone.
Yeah.
Have you had that experience?
I have. And I've learned because scenes will come to me that don't fit in the current book. And I always just write the scene out, finish the scene, and then I just file it. And it's interesting how later in another book or later in the story, all of a sudden it's like, oh, yeah, I could plug this in here. So, yeah, I'm a big believer in if it comes to you, just write it down, because you never know. You don't know why it's coming.
Right.
And it may be of use. It may not be of use. But at least if it is, you have it on hand and you're not racking your brain to try and remember what it was that you were thinking of.
Yeah, delete is an easy thing to do.
Exactly.
You just know that once you do, you can't get it back.
Exactly.
But if you don't put it on down on paper or on your keyboard or someplace in the first place, you can't delete.
Yeah, and your brain just deletes, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So it's like, wait, I had this perfect line. What happened to it? And it's like, I don't know. It's gone. Something else came in and booted it out.
Well, I want to go back to when we first started the conversation in reference to your experience in the OR.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, where it's organized bedlam, you know.
It can be, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Especially, well, I've never really worked anywhere other than main OR. And so in the main OR, you do, and that's particularly true these days, you do the more serious trauma procedures, you do the more serious regular procedures. Patients are more ill, there are more complicating factors. So, and there's usually call. So you could get called in the middle of the night to do something that happened as a result of an accident or whatever. So it's a wonderful school for learning how to quickly assess the situation and figure out what you're going to do, because you don't necessarily have a lot of time. And I have been accused outside of the OR of being a little too direct. And as I've said to people, well, I grew up in the OR, and in the OR there isn't always time to go, excuse me, I really don't mean to interrupt you, and I'm sorry to bother you, but it's like, I need this, I need it now, let's get it. And so I tend to be someone who generally cuts through the politically correct stuff or the BS and gets to the point. And sometimes that's not very well received.
Does that get reflected in your writing, in the style and the way the story unfolds?
Yeah. A number of people who've read the book who know me say Annie is me. I would say she's a lot more bullheaded and brave than I am, and curious. I mean, I'm curious, but there are things that she does that I would be like, yeah, I don't think so. And the reviews that I've gotten have mentioned the humor and the Annie's personality and the way that she can be related to. So yeah, I do mm-hmm. think it's, you know, it has to have some effect. Mm-hmm. My experience in the OR is actually what triggered this story. Years ago, I helped take care of a young woman who had some very, very puzzling neurological symptoms. In fact, they had progressed to the point where, she was comatose, and, she would come to the OR periodically for, what we used to do in the OR, which a lot of it is done now, in the ICU or whatever, like a central catheter to provide meds and IV fluids rather than sticking an IV in somebody's hand, or a gastrostomy tube. Anyway, our anesthesiologist at the time also worked in the ICU, and so there was lots of conversation about what was going on with this girl and how puzzled most of the docs taking care of her were. They eventually figured it out, but I can't go there because that's a spoiler. So
keep us hanging there.
Yeah,
so to
speak. But at the time I thought, wow, this would make a great story.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started it then, and then life got in the way. I got a new job, got a new husband, and eventually got a daughter. And so it got put on the shelf, and then I found it 3 years ago and read through what I had written to that point and thought, I really like this. I think I'm going to come back and finish this out, see where it goes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm imagining that when I used that term before, organized bedlam, about the OR, because it is a controlled situation, it must be.
Yes.
Okay. As opposed to, somewhat opposed to the ER, in which it immediate, boom, it's there in front of you, whereas you really can't even plan out in an ER. I'm wondering if you were, you know, someone who was in the ER quite a bit, how that might impact.
You know, we often, especially with emergencies, will get a patient directly from the ER. Mm-hmm. So the patient is taken to the ER and stabilized to a certain extent and then brought up to the OR for whatever procedure. And one of the things I say in the book, when Annie's taking care of an emergency procedure, it turns out to be someone she knows, is that the OR can look very chaotic to an outsider, but in an emergency, everybody comes together. People show up to help that aren't assigned to the case. They help pull equipment, they help set things up, they help open supplies, they help count instruments. And it's, I liken it to a ballet. Mm-hmm. They know how to work well together, and they know how to work under stressful situations. And I think that's true of both the ER and the OR. And I also say at one point that working in the ER or the OR, you get used to the adrenaline rush and you kind of crave it when you're not there. I mean, there are still days when I think, kind of miss that.
Uh-huh.
Now, I also don't want to be on my feet for 12 hours a day anymore. So,
yeah. You know, but when you're describing that, Helen, what came to mind for me was the old TV series and the movie MASH.
Yeah. MASH really wasn't bad at portraying that. That, I think, is an irritation for most people like me to watch some of the shows on TV and go, oh, my God, that would not happen. You know, in fact, I used to watch House with my daughter, and she finally turned to me one evening and said, Mother, you have to stop. This is a TV show. If you can't stop, you need to go upstairs and let me watch this by myself. And it was like, but she goes, I don't want to hear any buts. Just watch the show or go.
Right, right.
Yeah, but MASH was good. It kind of captured that sense of chaos or urgency, in addition to capturing how well you can work with a team. Yeah, and it really is a team effort.
Yeah, you think of the two antagonists in a way, a Hawkeye and Hot Lips.
Yes.
And how they go at it.
Oh, yeah.
But as soon as they got in the emergency, they were a team, and it was strictly professional. And, you know, that value they found in one another, too. That's a powerful motif to carry through to stories, I would think.
It is. And some ORs are better at that than others. When I worked at the Children's Hospital in the main OR, it was the first experience for me where there really was a collegial effort between the docs and the nurses. They respected you. They respected what you contributed. They were fantastic at teaching you, in addition to the residents that came through. And it was an amazing experience. I learned so much. Mm-hmm. Not all ORs are that way, and it's unfortunate because I think it benefits everyone, including most of all the patient.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of those things where I've always said with the OR, you either love it or you hate it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know pretty quickly which way you feel. And a lot of people come because they see this kind of shiny, sexy, fast-paced atmosphere, and then they get the reality, and they're like, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
I could
totally understand that. And, you know, just the whole thing, what happens with the human body when it goes into trauma of some sorts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a pleasant to experience when you're right there and it is happening to in front of you. That it has to, you know, first of all, take a certain mindset, steely, whatever it is, an ability to look at it and not get offended, grossed out and everything. And yet at the same time, it probably helps condition you, I would think, you know, into a perspective of life also.
Yeah. Well, and I think what drew me to the OR, when I was in nursing school back in the day, you actually got to rotate through the OR and the recovery room, and you actually were there for more than a day, which is currently the most that most nursing students get is a day or two in the OR, which that is unfortunate because I don't think that gives you any taste for what it's really like. But the thing I liked the most during that experience and what made me determined to work in the OR was I loved seeing what was on the inside. I loved seeing what was wrong and what needed to be fixed. And I loved scrubbing in on a procedure so much. Circulating, which is a term a lot of people going, I don't know what you're talking about, but that's the nurse that isn't gowned and gloved and actually working on the sterile field. He or she's the nurse that's getting supplies, helping anesthesia, providing more stuff to the scrub team. And that role's very important too. But my love was scrubbing because I could be right in the thick of things and see what was going on.
You like to get into the guts.
I do. I do. It's kind of disgusting. I said to somebody not too long ago, they were talking about something, and I said, well, you know, I like the OR because you connect with the patient before the surgery for, you know, 15, 20, half an hour, and then you take them in the OR and they're put to sleep, and that's when the fun starts. And they looked at me and went, what do you mean fun? And I said, that's when you get to do the procedure. Yeah. That's when you get to see what's wrong, and that's when you get to try and fix it. For me, that's fun.
Yeah.
I can talk to anybody for 30 minutes. So, you know, even a patient that's having difficulty or a child with parents who are having difficulties, you can handle that.
Let me ask you, it's an intriguing conversation. So you have these conversations with the patient.
Mm-hmm.
You know you're going to be cutting into him or mm-hmm. her in a short time, and you start to connect with that patient.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a helpful to get to know him or her a bit, you know, just in a personal level so that you could detach so that you could professionally do your job.
Yes.
Yet at the same time, don't lose sight of the humanity of that person. It's not a body in front of you. It's a human being.
Right. Well, I think the thing that most OR nurses know is that no matter who you are, no matter how minor the procedure, most people are scared when they come to the OR.
Yeah.
It's an unknown. You're going to be cutting into them. They don't know if it's going to go well. They don't know how they're going to feel afterwards necessarily. And so if you can make a connection, if you can tell them that you're the one that will be taking care of them mm-hmm. when they're having their surgery, and if you can listen to try and answer their questions as best as possible, I think they then connect with you and they know that as far as possible, they're going to be safe. And I think that's important.
Do you move that then into your work, you know, with Annie Collins and your other characters to draw on that aspect of nursing? It's not just somebody goes in there and, you know, traditional kind of, oh, you change the bed pans or something
exactly.
like that. It's like,
exactly.
oh, no, we do a whole lot more.
Yeah, well, you know, Annie, as I mentioned, she ends up doing a trauma case on a friend who is connected with Libby, who's beaten very badly. And so she circulates on the case. She knows him. She already has made a connection with this person and has a lot of empathy for where he's at in the grand scheme of things with Libby and whatnot. And so he's in ICU for a number of days, and she spends a fair bit of time when she has breaks and stuff sitting by his bedside and talking to him, even though he's not conscious. And I think there are always patients who touch you very deeply, and I think all patients make a connection and you want the best for them. Mm-hmm. Some hit you harder than others.
And that would seem, Helen, important. And I want to remind our listening audience, this is Jerry Fabianica on KYGT LP FM 102.7, 103.9. And this is Writer's Talk on the Rabbit Hole. And visiting here with Helen Starbuck, talking about her work, The Mad Hatter's Son, and her work to put it together, and her work prior to that, and still ongoing in the OR,
yeah,
and how it all loops together, too. And intriguing conversation, because we're not just talking about literature and writing, but also when we started the conversation, you said, I write about what I know.
Yes.
And that's critical for any author. For me to write about the OR, it ain't going to happen, you know.
Well, there are some things I've had to write about that I'm not familiar with. I needed to talk to a homicide detective, right. And Facebook is wonderful because I just put out a question. I said, does anybody out there know a homicide detective? And one of my best friends said, yeah, my cousin's a retired homicide. And so she put me in touch with Joe Marino, who's a retired homicide detective. And the poor man had a lot of strange questions asked of him. And then for the second book, I had no experience with this at all. I wanted to know what it felt like to shoot a gun. And so there's a firing range store in Denver who has a class called Pistols for Ladies. So I went to that, okay. And got to shoot a gun, and it turns out I'm kind of a dead-eye dick on the target. I hope I never have to find out in real life. But that was a lot of fun, and so... you know, I've talked to a lot of different people, have an ER doc on tap that I've talked to, have a pain management nurse that I've talked to. So that's been the fun part, right, of writing. And of course, all my Googling of things, my younger sister Lorelai and I were joking, and she suggested I help a relative along, and I said, Lori, I can't do that. If I did anything like that, all the police would have to do is look at my laptop and look at my search in the last year, and they'd just take me and lock me up.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, so that's a lot of the fun of it is.
And there is that background research, because as your story expands, mm-hmm, if it were simply in the OR, you know, from the, yeah, start to finish, you're good.
Yeah.
But you've had a crime that happened prior to, mm-hmm, so there's police work in there.
Yes.
Is the district attorney involved, you know?
Yeah.
Is there a minister or a priest that comes in to do the spiritual end of it? You know, I mean, yeah, I'm not suggesting there is,
yeah,
but if you would... what does that look like? You know, have you, you know, and I was on a panel discussion a few weeks ago at the Book Fest, and we talked about the relationship of our stories in Colorado to the environment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my first leap is to the mountains and,
yes,
and how they reflect, you know, environment outdoors. Well, during the discussion, someone brought up, well, what about the urban environment? And I said, excellent points. So I brought that. But then you have a very specific environment, and that's called EOR, a hospital. Yes.
Well, and the story is also set in Denver, okay, primarily the central Denver, so not a suburb. The hospital Annie works at is a Denver hospital, and she lives in Washington Park, she and her neighbor, Angel. And so there's a lot of local stuff, and having grown up in Colorado, that just felt natural to me. Although the two independent reviews that the book got, they both mentioned that it was a lot of fun to read about Denver. And then there's one foray up to Estes Park. Mm-hmm. So I think even for readers who aren't local, I always enjoy, when I read a book, if it's set somewhere else, I enjoy hearing about the place.
Absolutely. And oftentimes, you know, we think of the TV shows, NCIS, mm-hmm. Las Vegas, San mm-hmm. Francisco, New York. They're always the big cities.
Right.
And the last time I remember a TV series centered on Denver was called Dynasty back in.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember
you know,
that, too.
Evans, you know, and, you know, Blake Carrington. Oh, Blake.
And Crystal.
Crystal, that's who it was. Yeah, Crystal yeah. Carrington. Her yeah. whole line was, oh, Blake, you know.
Yes,
and, but Joe Collins was the best as Alexis.
Yeah, yeah. She was just evil.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's a great part.
Loved Alexis. But and Joe Collins just pulled that off like, yeah. But you're right, and that's the fun part about you know, an aspect of reading literature written by Colorado authors,
mm-hmm.
whether it's set in the urban area, primarily Denver.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you say, yep, the police were chasing Spear Boulevard,
there
bingo,
you go.
I'm already thinking Spear, and you say cross Broadway, boom, I'm there.
Well, you know? And two of the homeless people that Annie talks to hang out around the Grant and Spear Bridge
okay.
mm-hmm. in that area. And again, my sister Lori and I spend a lot of time talking about this nonsense, but I was driving along Spear trying to find a place, and I said to her, damn, this urban renewal, they've cleaned everything up. I'm having a hell of a time finding a spot where these two could kind of hang out and camp out. And then another day I was driving by and there were grocery carts and people in sleeping bags on the side of, and so I thought, okay, well, this is still viable. So, you know, it's fun to find places and then go research it and make sure you're not talking off the top of your head.
Yes. And I'm doing that in my current novel, because I have a scene in which the assistant district attorney in Denver. So they're at the city and county mm-hmm. building mm-hmm. there on Bannock.
Mm-hmm.
And so the two of them leave and they go for a run along the Cherry Creek Trail.
Yes.
So I'm picturing in my head, I've been there. So I wrote it all out. But before I go to final, I'm literally going to go down there, go out that door, go along there, cross the street, go down, make sure there are steps down, because it has to be authentically
real.
And if you make a mistake, someone's going
we'll
to find
yes.
and it questions your whole credibility as an author.
It's true. Well, you'll enjoy it, because I've noticed, and I don't know if the city hired them to do this, but some wonderful artists have done murals on the cement sidewalls
okay.
down by the plat. And they're a lot of fun to look at as you drive past. But if you know a DA in Denver, I need a connection, because I need to talk to one of them. And I've had a heck of a time finding anybody. So
actually, I know one in Clear Creek.
Oh, well, see, that would even yeah. help. That would even help. So
you're on. So we'll talk. When
yeah.
You're
okay.
Off
good.
There. Get you connected there, because yeah, I'm tapping into his resource too. You know, because you want someone with the eye who knows
yes.
that. And
yes.
And like I have a friend here in the local sheriff's department
mm-hmm.
was able to read my work. But again, because you need that, and it's something he had picked up, because I had this dialogue with the characters. And the only thing because I had said the detectives that came were from the Denver Sheriff's Office. And he said, no, they'd come from the police office.
Yes.
The department, I should say. Not the sheriff. That's a whole different thing there. He says, other than that, the dialogue was perfect. You know, the kind of exchange. And I felt really good about
yeah.
that. So it was really a technical thing. But it's critical to get that down.
Well, it is. And I fondly remember one of the conversations I had with Joe, my homicide detective. And I was asking him questions about what sort of security setup would you have on a felon that had been brought to a hospital from the prison, because what had happened to him couldn't be treated at the prison? And he was saying, well, you know, there'd be a cop in the room and there'd be a cop by the door. And I said, okay, I don't want too many cops, because I want this person to have an opportunity to escape. He goes, well, there'd be two cops. Mm-hmm. And I kept saying, well, what about if there, and he goes, well, there'd be two cops.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to figure out a way to accommodate the two cops, and he just kept saying, well, there'd be a cop inside, there'd be a cop outside.
Yeah.
And it's like,
yeah,
well, do I dare take enough literary license? And then I thought, nah, just stick with what it is, and
right.
you'll figure a way around it. And I did. So
yeah. No, that's important. And and similar to that I learned was that if someone, perpetrates a crime of some sort, and they're severely wounded, mm-hmm. whatever. And they take him in. The first thing is to save their life.
Yes.
So they take him in, and they go into the emergency room, and they get treated. They're in the hospital, and they can't be released. It's
right.
fairly life-threatening. You know, so, you know, perhaps in critical condition or very serious condition. And then is that individual who pretty obviously committed the crime, but still is accused, mm-hmm. and is he arraigned? Is he put under arrest? And what I had learned is that oftentimes that what the police department will do, they will not put him under arrest immediately, because if they do, they're responsible for his medical bills.
Yes.
But they will stand outside of the door, and I forget the technical term for it. Nobody goes in that room
right.
without going through the cop first. You know,
right.
he's on guard there until that person can be moved out, then you're under arrest.
Yes.
You know, but it comes down, it's a very practical economic mm-hmm. reason, financial
yeah.
reason. They don't
yeah.
do that. I didn't know that. So
yeah, it's amazing what you learn. That's been one of the really fun things, is the things you learn.
mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's fantastic here. Have you started your next work then?
Yes, actually the next book is with my editor, and she promises me I'll have it by the end of April.
Wow, you're moving along, because you just got this other one.
Well,
out,
this
what, about six
the
months ago?
The first one came out in October, so we think this one, if everything goes well, will probably come out this coming October as well. So it's been about a year, and for me as a reader / fan, that's about as long as I can stand. And unfortunately, some of my favorite authors, one of them is coming on to 3 years now, and it's like, oh, would you just please hurry up?
Yeah.
And I've had a lot of people say, when's the next book coming out? And so it sounds like there are people who are interested to get it, and but it does take time, as I know, as I'm sure you know. You know, you got to get people to read it and tell you where you screwed up. And then you got to get somebody to edit it that tells you more of where you screwed up.
Oh, you should get my editor. She's really good at that.
Yeah. Mine is too. Fortunately, she's got a great sense of humor.
Oh, yeah. No, it's awesome.
And then you got to have somebody to proof it who says, yeah, this is where you screwed up on punctuation and that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. And then finally, it gets published. But it's quite a project. That's another thing I've learned. It's amazing what the process is.
And what I found in doing this show for a couple of years too, Helen, and talking to authors, knowing my own experience, but then my listeners too,
mm-hmm.
and what they now really begin to understand and appreciate, how complex producing a well-written story novel it takes, you know, to do, and the whole variety. You and I write in fiction,
mm-hmm.
and that's challenging. So it's a creative aspect there. But then, like, we go down to the CEPA meetings, and I got to know, and I have a friend who published a children's book
mm-hmm.
with all the pictures, the graphics, everything
yeah.
like that. To me, that's even more challenging,
because oh, yeah.
it's far more complex, even though the story is very simple. But to take a story down to, you know, kindergarten level and put all the right pictures that are enticing, that is not an easy thing to do.
Well, and I've discovered that I actually was very lucky in finding my editor, because I was just Googling mystery editors. And then she gave me the name of a cover artist who also does the layout for the book and the ebook. Mm-hmm. And Gail has done an amazing job. So I'm going to keep using her. And then I got involved in doing an audiobook of the first book. And that has been amazing, because they put out an audition.
Mm-hmm.
And there were probably 30 people who auditioned for it. So then you have to listen to these people. And I got to the point where I had to literally keep track of it on paper, because after a while they all start to sound alike.
Right.
And yet while you're listening to them, it's like, yes, I like this character. Ooh, gosh, that character's not going to work.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty complicated process.
It is. Yeah. It's awesome though. It's so fulfilling. And to move is it, in a way, you and I share stories, our stories, you know, you were professionally OR. I was a teacher. So there's probably some because I was operating on, you know.
Yeah, you were operating on brains.
But to move from that realm into writing.
Yes.
In literature, because it's something we both love. You know, we love to read. We love to get vested in stories, you know, and the character is, to me, the critical. And oftentimes the environment becomes the setting becomes a character, too. But, you know, the development of that, and you just attach to these individuals here, and you want to know more. And that's a very fulfilling aspect. So when people read your work, when they're done, they go, well, what happens next with Eddie?
Yeah, I've had a lot of people say that. It's, oh, my God, what's going to happen? You know, and that's how I kind of felt about it, too. So the character development is a lot of fun to see where that's going to go and make them human and make them appealing to readers.
Well, if people want to find out more about your work, get in touch with you, whatever, how do they do that?
Well, I have a website, helenstarbuck.com. It gives little blurbs about the upcoming books, and I, closer to probably July or August, I'm going to post the first chapter of the next book kind of as a treat and come on. That will also be added to the first paperback and the ebook, and then it'll be on the audiobook as well. I'm on Facebook, Helen Starbuck, and I'm also on Twitter at Helen S. Starbuck. So any of those ways would be good to contact me. And on my website, if people want to put their email in, then they will get a newsletter, and there's obviously the option to unsubscribe, and I promise not to bother people more than maybe once a month, so you won't be inundated with nonsense. So those are good ways to connect.
Right on. And if they wanted to get a copy, they can get it through your website, Amazon?
You can get it on Amazon, and you can also buy it at the Tattered Cover at all their locations. So I love the Tattered Cover. I believe in supporting independent bookstores. Right. So that would be a good place to buy it if you're local. But Amazon has all of it. And then when the audiobook comes out, I believe it'll be on Audible. Okay. So.
Yeah. With the Amazon. Is the ebook out then?
Ebook is out and it's on Amazon, and so is the paperback.
Audiobook is up and coming.
Audiobook, yeah. We're hoping by maybe mid-May that'll be available. So.
Yeah, it gives you an opportunity to listen to your whole story all over
again.
I've done that.
Yes. I'm anxious because all I've heard so far is a 15-minute reading, and I really like the person who's reading it, but I won't get to hear the whole thing until it's done, and it's
really
I'm kind of on pins and needles about that.
No, I listen to everything, so I get feet, because literally, you know, every once in a while I'll miss a word or something like that, and then I would have to go back to him and say, oh no, on this page here, you know, whatever. And he could do that because it's all electronic, get in there, and he has a professional studio, you know, so, you know, able to get done. But I mean the hours that you put into producing something like that, and you know, hopefully people well receive and it sells and stuff like that.
But, it's doing well. They always say first books, it takes a while to build an audience. So sometimes I think people, I know I've done that with a couple series. I actually picked up a second book in the series, and then I usually end up going back and reading the first one. Just to kind of get the backstory. You know, I'm hoping that as time goes on, we'll get more and more readers, and it'll take off.
Well, yeah. And I know you killed it at the Georgetown Christmas Market.
I did. It went really well, which was amazing to me because it is a Christmas market and it's very family oriented. And so I wasn't sure how it goes, but I sold 13 copies of the book, and then sold another 9 at the Colorado Authors League Book Festival, which, considering there were more than 100 authors there, I thought that was pretty good. So I'm pleased.
Yeah, you should be. And congratulations on all of that there. And, And, you know, and the up-and-coming work will be up. Does it have a title yet?
Yes. It's No Pity in Death.
Oh, okay. That's very...
And believe me, I was sweating blood trying to figure out a title because
You were an OR nurse, sweating blood, all the gore.
Yeah,
all coming down. All the visual imagery.
But I'll tell you, those titles, they're almost impossible for me to come up with. You know, it takes... My brain was about ready to explode on this one.
But I'll go back to something you were saying about the 3 a.m. thing. Because,
yes.
And how characters' names come to you. Because yes. I had a primary character
yeah.
in the novel. Initially, his name was Greg.
Mm-hmm.
And something at the end said, no, his name is Daniel.
Yeah.
So I changed all the Gregs, and it drove my editor absolutely crazy. It was hilarious because I did one of those word things. Search and replace. And it replaced every Greg, including the word like congregation came out, condanulation. Oh, my God. And it was like almost 300 pages I had.
Yeah, you have to do find next.
Yep.
And then replace. Find next and then replace. If you replace them all...
Yeah.
It can get out of hand.
Fortunately, it underlined them all in red, so that it jumped out of me.
Good.
It took 3 or 4.
That's good.
But it was important because then my next novel, it came from, because that's the character I'm drawing on, Daniel, and I'm calling In the Lion's Den.
Oh, yeah, yeah. See?
So Daniel in the Lion's Den. So it had to be. So it's one of those, you listen to that inner voice. That something is here, say, no. It's not Greg, it's Daniel. It's not, you know, Suzanne, it's Annie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why?
Oh,
There's something resonating in there because our names carry power also.
Well, and I mean, it's like her next door neighbor, Angel Cisneros, that name just popped. You know, that's the nickname his family gave him, and it's rather appropriate. And it just stuck, and it felt good all the way through, as did Annie. Not sure why, but they just, you know, they do come to you.
Yeah. And probably because she needed to be Annie. So,
she needed to be Annie.
Right on. All right. Well, Helen Starbuck, thanks again so much for coming in.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah. It was a great conversation. And, Mad Hatter's Son. Can be got at the Tattered Cover.
And on Amazon.
And your website is?
Yes. HelenStarbuck.com.
There we go. Easy enough to remember.
Yeah.
And to close out this portion of the program here, let's go back to something we talked about at the very beginning. And your favorite Beatle was?
Paul.
And it now is?
John.